Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you know, at different stages of my life, friends would get in touch with me and maybe say, "Oh, I heard you talking about such and such on the radio. It was really funny." Or, "I enjoyed the interview you did with such and such a person." Or, "I saw you on TV the other night." That was at one stage of my life. At this stage, all I ever get is people texting me and saying, "Oh, can you tell Ed that I saw him or on this thing, or I read this thing he wrote, and just tell him how good it was."
Aww, that's so nice.
Well, it's nice for you. I'm referring to a friend of mine, an old friend of mine who works in the wedding industry. She's a wedding celebrant, told me that your article in The Guardian about viable jobs meant a lot to her. It meant a lot to her.
Oh, that's so kind of her.
That you mentioned the wedding industry in there.
Well, I do think it's quite terrible, this sort of writing off lots of businesses and, you know, businesses and jobs and people who kind of love what they do. And it's obviously true of the kind of the arts community, weddings, events and others. So, that is incredibly nice of you. I think we should draw attention to the fact that we are four today, Jeff.
Yes. So usually when we're doing this, Joel sits in on the Zoom calls and monitors us, makes notes of things that need editing out, through fear of preserving Ed's public image. But today we've been monitored doubly. Zoe is on here as well. Zoe Gelber, who works on the programme.
Yes, and does our brilliant newsletter and has been doing research for the programme. So it's incredibly nice.
I hope Zoe's enjoying you staring at yourself in the Zoom camera and fixing your hair.
Thank you for drawing attention to that.
It was quite dramatic. On one hand, you're talking about how nice it is to have Zoe here. On the other hand,
you're such a bugger.
Fixing your fringe.
Actually, I mean, I do want to say thank you very much for the opal fruits, which I'm very much enjoying, because after our discussion of opal fruits last week, you sent me two. I mean, I was impressed, and my children were impressed, but it said limited edition.
Yeah. So, of course, they've been Starburst for probably a couple of decades at this point.
How did you get them?
Well, as we were talking, I Googled opal fruits, and it turned out they'd done this limited edition earlier this year, because the flavours are slightly different.
Wow. Well, in what way?
So in Starburst, I think the lime and the lemon is combined, whereas in opal fruits, you would have a separate lime and a separate lemon.
Definitely. I don't approve of the lime and the lemon being combined.
No.
I mean, to be honest, you know, it's so interesting, because maybe this is the auto-suggestion of the slogan, but my mouth is watering as we speak.
Well, as we were talking about them last week and I Googled it, I saw that they'd done this limited edition, and there were only two bags left online to be bought.
Oh.
So I thought, I've got to buy those and send them to Ed before one of our listeners snaps them up.
I think I should preserve one of them and maybe then sort of auction them off in 20 years' time. I mean, but what is it about opal fruits that makes your mouth water?
I think it's just that you're highly suggestible, and the advert said opal fruits made to make your mouth water, and it's having this Pavlovian effect on you.
I mean, this sounds like a desperate bid for sponsorship by opal fruits, doesn't it?
I mean, given that they don't exist anymore.
I promise you it is not. Anyway, so I mean, I'm really, I was incredibly touched.
Oh, I'm pleased you enjoyed them.
Incredibly touched. So how's your week been?
I went on, I did that government website questionnaire on what I could retrain as.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking it would give me a wealth of options, but the only thing that came up was sexual health advisor.
What?
I know.
I mean, I want to be careful here, but what gives you the qualifications to be a sexual health advisor?
Well, I'll be honest, there were no questions particularly pertaining to sexual health, and I wouldn't have pegged myself as somebody who had any great expertise in that area.
I'm not sort of leading in any direction here, but I just sort of wonder what...
I've no idea. The questions are all things like, do you like seeing a task through to its completion? And do you enjoy collaborating with other people? And that's what it spewed out for me.
I mean, I'm slightly wondering whether I should do it, but I'm slightly fearful of what the result might be.
I could see you as a private detective. There hasn't been a private detective like you before. They're all sort of quite dark and introspective and dealing with all these personal problems. Like a jolly, slightly nerdy private detective. There's a niche that nobody's exploited yet.
Do you think I'd be successful?
I think so. You've got an inquiring mind. Mm. Which TV detective do you most closely relate to?
Miss Marple.
Yeah.
We did try and get our kids to watch a film called Clue, which was based on the, you know, Clue.
Yeah, it's one of Sarah's favourite films, that. She loves it.
Didn't quite work with the children somehow.
Maybe in lieu of being able to do a Reasons to be Cheerful live show, we could do a big Zoom game of Cluedo at some point.
Ooh. But you think even more interesting than a Zoom game of Class Struggle?
Is that still in the British Museum?
I don't know, actually. I've lost track of it. Should we talk about what we're talking on the show?
Yes.
So this week we're having a couple of great conversations, which are sort of related to the US election, which is obviously in lots of people's minds. First, we're really excited to be talking to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who represents Minnesota in the House of Representatives. She was one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress in 2018 and is part of the squad of four young progressive Democrats alongside Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. And she's just written a book, This Is What America Looks Like, about her early life in Somalia, where she lived before fleeing during the Civil War, and her journey into politics. And we had a really interesting conversation with her, you and I, about her life, her politics, and the crises facing the US today. And then we've got a great conversation with a young activist, Will Lawrence, who's involved in the Sunrise Movement. That's a big part of the recent wave of youth-led climate activism in the US, and they've been championing the Green New Deal for the past few years. We're talking to Will about how the Sunrise Movement are organising in the election and what's at stake in November. And, you know, there is a lot to be worried about in the world today, and indeed in US politics. This is such an important moment. But I think that both of these conversations are good grounds for hope.
What's your reason to be cheerful this week?
Well, my reason to be cheerful, I mean, it's quite sort of self-referential, this really. But, you know, I've gone on this sort of swimming in the ponds thing. Well, I mean, this is a sort of boast, really, but I did four laps today and it was only 13 degrees.
Whoa. Have you ordered your wetsuit yet?
I have ordered the wetsuit. There will not be pictures available to you. It will, or if there are, they'll go in the vault along with the trampoline video and the Icelandic thermal baths. But I have to say the sort of putting on of the wetsuit is quite a business. I haven't quite got the hang of that yet.
Lots of talcum powder.
Chafing.
Yes. So did you just do it in your very small Speedos?
I did, yeah. What about you? Anything to report? Any reason to be cheerful?
I mean, not just a little one, just a little one. My son, who has started primary school, he's in reception, got picked to be the star helper the other day.
Aww.
Yeah, he got selected. It's very competitive. They choose a different star helper every day. And last Wednesday, he was chosen. The criteria for being chosen was largely to do with sitting up straight on the carpet. I think he managed that with aplomb, and then he got to stand at the front and help. So I'm very proud of him. I've had no actual achievements or joy in my own life this week, but I'm able to have that vicariously through him.
Aww. That's great.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. He's really going places.
I mean, let me just say to you, I think of you as a star helper every week, Jeff.
I'll change my LinkedIn profile.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So I'm delighted to say that we're now joined by Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman for Minnesota's 5th District and author of This Is What America Looks Like. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Maybe we can just start, because we were just talking about it before the tape went on. How's lockdown been for you? You're running for re-election during lockdown. You've won your primary. You're now running in the general election. You've got your family at home. How's that been?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I have four children. Three are in high school and one is in elementary. And so to navigate what it now means to help teach children while you're working full time and running for re-election has been interesting. Yeah. You know, I think the pandemic has done a lot of things, but what it's done is that it's taught us how to be flexible and creative. So,
yeah, well, that's definitely true. Your book is a fascinating account of your journey from Somalia as a refugee to Kenya, living in a refugee camp, to the election to the House of Representatives. I just wanted to start by asking you whether you might tell us about your early life and what impact it has on you still today.
Early life prior to Somalia erupting into a war zone, a civil war, was quite pleasant for me. You know, I grew up not needing much. I had a very loving family. The Somalia I knew then was a very thriving country, at least to an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved school. I was raised by educators and, you know, it was a very loving environment to grow up in. And then one morning we all woke up and nothing was the same. Everything that felt familiar, felt safe, felt joyful, felt happy was gone. And we ended up being forced out of Somalia and went to go seek asylum in Kenya and entered a refugee camp in Mombasa, in a coastal city, and lived there for 4 years. Eventually got sponsorship to resettle into the United States as refugees in 95.
I suppose the reason I asked the question partly just occurs to me is that both of my parents, well, my father's no longer alive, were refugees. He left Belgium at the age of 16 as a Jew fleeing from the Nazis, and my mum was in hiding in Poland during the Second World War. And I mean, it's hard to tell these things because who knows what effect it has on me and my upbringing, because I had a very stable family upbringing. But I definitely think it, you know, it had such effects on them, you know, even as they kind of grew up into a stable life in the UK.
I mean,
it never went away. I suppose it never really went away from them, I think.
It doesn't. You know, I think your sense of what is safe certainly shifts. And, you know, for me, I mean, it took me years to actually understand the these things tend to make me a little emotional. But I think for me, you know, you there's a sense of home that that you have when you know, like my children have a sense of home. This is a space where they're comfortable in. And when you are forcefully displaced, that sense of home is also displaced from you. And you are in constant search of a home, and not just in the physical sense, but in the emotional sense, right? You're looking to make yourself at home. And, you know, I think for me, it's probably, you know, one of the reasons I am an organizer and I am involved in community and am a public servant is, you know, that need to connect with people, to connect with my surrounding, to connect with something that's bigger than me, is driven really by that search for you know, normalcy and for the ability to ground yourself into something that can be real.
It's really interesting. You see, when I think about my father, everyone's experience is different. I always used to remember he didn't really like holidays very much because it gave him such a sense of sort of insecurity. He always used to say, you know, well, it's okay to go away, but it's so much nicer to be home. And I never quite understood it as a child. And I think it's partly because that sense of displacement never really leaves you somehow.
Yeah. I'm the same. I don't like travel. Any chance I have at a time off, I would rather, you know, sit in front of the TV and just stay in one place. And, you know, I think the other thing is that consistency is something, you know, that humans thrive on. And when you have a breakage in a life that you could have planned, could have been planned for you, it sort of pushes you to force your brain to be flexible. And for me, it is, you know, having anxieties around schedules and plans, because I know, you know, my older sisters talk about, you know, their plan for graduation and that never came. Their plans for, you know, what university they were going to go to that never came. Their plans for children and marriage that never came. And so I grew up sort of not really thinking about what tomorrow could be, but just hoping that I am alive to have a tomorrow. And that, you know, is some of the internal stuff that we will probably forever work through as people who have been forcefully displaced.
Yeah, well, that's incredibly moving. And striking. And when you first came to the US, it's striking in your book, you said, I think it was to your grandfather, was it, that you, or your father that you came with?
My father.
Your father, yeah, beg your pardon. You said, this isn't our America. This isn't the America I know. Sorry, I haven't got the exact phrase.
Yeah.
You arrived in New York, I think.
Yeah.
Just talk to us about that.
Well, you know, as Americans, we do a really exceptional job at exporting American exceptionalism around the world. And, you know, when there were opportunities for us to get resettled outside of the refugee camp, my grandfather and father were really excited to come to the United States because it was a place of opportunity and prosperity. And, you know, as we went through that process of getting the documents that we needed to be able to resettle to the United States, one of the last activities that you are required to do as a refugee coming to the U.S. is to go through an orientation where, you know, you get acclimated and are presented what American life is. And that American life could not be farther from, you know, from the truth for probably 90% of Americans. And when you're a kid, somebody tells you something, and when adults tell you things, you believe them, right? And so when we arrived, the first few images were of homeless people sleeping on the side of the streets. There was graffiti. I mean, it was New York, and now I know why this exists. But there was also just, you know, trash and garbage on the side of the road because it was at night, and that's you know, New York's deal in getting rid of their trash. But I didn't know that. And so to me, this couldn't be farther removed from, you know, the image that I had of America. And I said, well, this doesn't look like the America you promised. And you know, my father said, you know, we're going to get to our America. You just wait. Because I think even him, he was taken aback and thought, you know, we're still in transit. We're gonna get there, and I've continued to be in search of the creation of the America that I was first introduced to, and I want that to exist for, you know, the 90% of Americans who right now don't have their economic needs being met in order to live in that America.
And I mean, one of the other things that's very moving about your book is you had a tough time of it as a kid, you know, coming to resettle in America, didn't you? I mean, it was really, you really... You were tough. You had to be tough against some of the bullying and other things that you faced, and the sort of very, very unfamiliar world you'd entered.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the saying "what doesn't break you makes you stronger" is probably very true for me. I didn't really prepare myself, or didn't have the ability to prepare myself for what awaited me. And it was brutal, but you know, I'm built strong, so I made it through. And I feel like it sort of prepared me for life now in American politics, because there are a lot of bullies that need to be stood up to.
Definitely, and we'll come on to that. And the journey then takes you eventually into the state legislature in 2016, and then to Congress in 2018. What persuaded you? What drove you into politics itself, do you think?
Initially, I was drawn to politics because I was interested in helping my grandfather and other elders in the community access a democracy that was never accessible for them prior to coming to the United States. And eventually, you know, as I worked and got older and understood the inequities, I was baffled by people's inability really to understand how powerful they can be if they got involved. Because for me, there was a connection between the policies that were holding people back and the politicians they were electing or choosing to elect by not voting or participating. And, you know, had representation myself at the time, that was not really actively working to create progress for our community and for the district that I lived in. And she was there for over 40 years. And eventually I myself ended up challenging her and won that primary to unseat a 44-year incumbent. And for us, it was really about figuring out how we can get people to get excited about representation in a representative democracy. What changes could you have in the creation of policy and debate and shifting the narrative about why disparities continue to persist in our communities if you elected people who actually had fluency in the day-to-day struggles of a particular community?
And you, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley are part of the so-called squad. Do you think there's something distinctive about your approach, about the squad and what you're bringing to politics? I think it was sort of implicit in the answer you just gave. But, I mean, it's sort of shaking up the system and being willing to think, not we've done this way forever, and so we're going to carry on doing it this way, I guess.
I mean, for us, our lives have acutely been impacted by policies that were made without us at the table, right? Without our interests at the table, without our voices at the table, without our needs and hopes and aspirations at the table. And I don't mean us individually. I mean, like, us as in the communities we represent. And so when we are now given the honor and the privilege to represent ourselves and our communities, we know we don't have the luxury to wait. We don't have the luxury to only think about incremental changes. We don't have the luxury to not have righteous anger in wanting this system to work for all of us. And to a lot of our colleagues, the idea of going hungry, being a renter, not having health insurance, all of those things are abstract ideas to them. This is what their constituents might talk to them. This is not their lived experience now, or hasn't been for probably a decade or two. And for us, this is probably the most secure paycheck we've had. And so that is urgent and constant part of the work that we do, because we know as we sit and debate, there are people like we would have been who are struggling to pay their rent, who are struggling to put food on the table, who are struggling to find a nice school for their children to go to, who are struggling to, come up with even like the change it takes for you to get on a bus or a train. And I know that the majority of my colleagues who are millionaires haven't thought about that in a long time. But it was just yesterday that I was thinking about that. And so I want to have these changes be talked about, and I want these policies implemented, because I know people don't have the luxury of waiting.
You talk about this toughening up, this thickening of your skin in your early experiences of being an American, preparing you for the bullying within politics. If we talk about President Trump, when he attacked you as he did for not being born in America, is that water off a duck's back to you?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's become important for me to respond and remind him, what an American is and who is an American. Because there are a lot of people who not only identify with me as a member of Congress, but identify with me as a new immigrant in this country, as a refugee, you know, as Muslim, as a woman. And so for us to take him on, it's an important part of this work of representation, because, you know, when he's attacking me and he solely only does it because of my identities, right? He's never said anything about my policy, my intelligence, you know, my ability to represent my constituents, a single policy that I advocate for that he's against. So we're not adversaries in a political debate. We are adversaries in an understanding of what it means to be American and who has the right to access, you know, constitutional rights in this country. He presents himself as this strong bully who is going to put people in their places, who is going to be between them and everyone else who's out there to harm them. And he has decided to say that Muslims are coming to get you, immigrants are coming to get you, refugees are coming to get you, Black people are coming to get you. And he can't continue to say that if he hasn't had the ability to, right, like to take down the one person who sort of has all of those identities still in power and is still in Congress. And so I think that piece is really what drives him and why he continues to say, you know, it's because of Ilhan I'm going to win a particular district, because he knows it's because of me that he lost Minnesota in 2016. And it's going to be because of me that he will lose Minnesota in 2020.
How do you think we put that hate back in, you know, the divisions that he's exploited? It's easy to feel very pessimistic about the long-term effects of that. How do we put it back in its box? How do we defeat it?
I would be rich if I had the answer to that. but, you know, I've experienced the bad, ugly, and good in my life. And I know that monsters can be created overnight. And I also know that people of goodwill can work together to overpower that monster or these monsters. And I think, you know, it's going to take all of us to start the work of cleansing hearts once this election is over and we have put away the main monster. People are not born to hate. And I know that this is something that is learned and something that people are exposed to. And that gives me hope, because I know then the opposite can be done. They can unlearn, and they can be exposed to compassion and be tolerant and accepting, and be good-willed.
Something we wanted to ask you about is you represent the district where George Floyd was killed earlier this year, and you've been in office during this incredibly difficult period for you, your district, and the United States as a whole. How's it been, and how's your community doing?
Minneapolis is quite resilient, and so we have been in the process of picking up the pieces and And figuring out not only how to hold the space for one another, but what rebuilding looks like, and what reimagining our safety and our progress should be. And, you know, people have been more honest about what kind of community they want to live in. And the progress they want us to make, and how much they are tired of the hashtags and, you know, and the Black Lives Matter slogans, when they are not seeing people legislate in a way that makes them believe they understand and care for Black lives. And I'm excited really for where we can go together as a community once we figure out what public safety should look like for us and what real investment in the needs of the community are.
I'm interested, just as we come towards the end, you've been in Congress 2 years. I wonder if this is a fair question, how you think what you've learned over these last 2 years as a representative in Congress. I mean, you know, it must have been a roller coaster ride. You've been a target for President Trump. You've been honest enough to say you got some things wrong, some remarks you made about Israel and so on. But what have you learned most of all, I guess?
I mean, what I've learned is that there is an opportunity with every challenge. And if you're willing to see the opportunities, I think, you know, that's important right now, even in the context of what people are experiencing with the movements that are happening or even with the presidential election. You know, we oftentimes as humans allow for ourselves to be in despair, because there are severe challenges. And I think what these moments have taught us, what the last 4 years have taught us, is that there is great opportunities out there for us to reshape our society, for us to advocate for policies that people were not before, and for us to lead in ways that are not traditional. And so that is, I will say, has been the greatest lesson of my last 2 years.
And the title of this podcast is Reasons to be Cheerful. So as we close, give us a reason to be, I mean, you've given us many reasons to be cheerful in this interview, I think, but give us a reason to be cheerful.
In 5 days in Minnesota, more people have already voted than in the last primary. So that this morning I woke up to that, and that has made me very cheerful.
Well, look, Congresswoman Omar, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Your book, This Is What America Looks Like, is definitely worth our listeners reading. We wish you all the best of luck, and keep blazing the trail you've been blazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit UH1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Well, to give us even further cause for optimism from United States politics, we're going to talk to Will Lawrence, who is co-founder and director of partnerships at the Sunrise Movement, which has grown to be one of the most influential climate advocacy groups in the United States. There are hubs in over 250 cities. There are thousands of volunteers across the country. And Will, you were there at the beginning. Tell us about you. Tell us about how it started and tell us about what the idea is.
Thanks so much, Jeff, for having me. So Sunrise was born out of the youth climate movement in the United States. I'm here in Lansing, Michigan, and had been involved for several years. In the middle of the last decade, a couple of my friends and I, we felt that the work that had been happening was kind of reaching the end of its road, if you will. And we started looking around, asking how we could take the next step and put our heads together, actually did a year of strategic planning with 12 folks, really going deep into understanding American politics, social movements, and eventually launched Sunrise in the spring of 2017.
And what were the founding ideas of Sunrise?
Well, folks before us had done an incredible job of building a social movement around climate change in the United States. But we found that, especially by 2016, we were seeing new opportunities in the political arena, and the climate movement wasn't taking those opportunities. There was kind of this idea that you have protest movements, advocacy groups over here, and you have electoral campaigns and politicians over here, and never the two shall meet, right? Either you try to get people elected or you protest them, and you would never do both. But we saw the rise of Bernie Sanders in late 2015, early 2016, and saw so many people in the climate movement get inspired by him. And yet the institutions we had in the climate movement were not prepared to take advantage of that excitement. And so that was one major thing we wanted to build on, was to bring the power that the movement had built in years prior into the political arena, and then use that combat in the political arena to strengthen our movements on the outside.
So the 12 of you lock yourselves away for a year. You're like cardinals choosing a new pope. You come out. What is the strategy, Jay? How do you go about this process of selecting candidates who are passionate about these issues?
Well, this is an interesting moment, you know, because we were literally, you know, we had some relationships and some experience, but we were literally, you know, 12 people at the beginning, and all we had was a plan. And the plan was, our mission statement is to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process. That's the big goal. We said we're going to do it in four steps. Year one, we're going to build the movement through doing small actions. Year two, we are going to make climate change matter in the 2018 midterm election. Year three, we are going to create an inescapable moral crisis around the fact of climate change and the opportunity to create millions of good jobs tackling it. In year four, we're going to rally to get rid of Donald Trump. So we had that four-step plan kind of laid out at the beginning, and we've been kind of filling in the details and having to work with it since then, because I can't claim to have anticipated the coronavirus or a number of other things that have happened since then. That was kind of how we laid it out.
And on the subject of the election, obviously the most visible aspect of that is the Biden presidency, and to some extent he is visible as this quite centrist candidate. He's got the job of winning over these floating voters and perhaps people who supported Trump in 2016. It seems a little bit like he's trying to keep the Green New Deal at arm's length in all this. Where are these ideas within the Democratic Party more generally?
Well, the Democratic Party establishment is clearly running from the Green New Deal brand, but they have adopted Green New Deal style policies into their platform. We're talking about massive investments in job creation, doing things like retrofitting every building in the United States to be more sustainable, delivering clean water to every citizen in this country, every person in this country, by overhauling our water infrastructure, by building out accessible mass transit, all these things creating millions and millions of jobs, putting people back to work, not to mention other jobs in the green economy like caring for people, nursing jobs, teaching jobs. You know, these are not the traditional hard hat jobs that you think about, but they are green jobs that are a part of a sustainable society. So that's what the Green New Deal is about. And that's actually what Joe Biden is talking about in his platform. And talking about doing that, by the way, in a way that is also deeply addressing the crisis of racial injustice that we have in our country by allocating 40% of every dollar invested to communities that have been historically marginalized or disinvested, especially communities of color, black communities, indigenous communities, and others. And so that's all in Joe Biden's platform. And those are the ideas that were popularized through the conversation around the Green New Deal. Now, clearly, we would prefer for them to be championing the Green New Deal in name rather than just in concept. But frankly, we'll take it, given where we are. Joe Biden wasn't our chosen candidate, but he is the one that we've got. And it's clear that we all have to rally to defeat Donald Trump. And then we really do believe that we can get started on a Green New Deal in 2021, should the Democrats win.
Now, Will, you mentioned that part of your strategy was around candidates and the 2018 election. And we've just come off the back of an interview with Ilhan Omar. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, that small number of really leading voices have really played an important role, haven't they, in pushing this movement forward?
Sunrise's theory of change has three main pillars. One is that we're going to build people power in the streets. Two is that we're going to build political power to deliver champions to office and have them fight for us. And three is that we're going to align with other movements who are working towards similar aims. And that point two, that we'd have political champions, when we released this in 2017, purely conceptual. There was not a single person who we could call a champion on climate change in the United States Congress. Maybe Bernie Sanders. Maybe that would be the one. But the idea that you could have a social movement aligned with an elected official who would not only fight for you in the halls of Congress, but would actually do things that help the movement grow on the outside in the process, that was totally imaginary. And then in 2018, we endorsed AOC. We can't claim to have done, in fairness, very much at all to get her elected because we were still very small at that point. But some of our friends did a lot of work. And then 1 week after Election Day in November 2018, she joined us in sitting in at Nancy Pelosi's office, who's the Speaker of the House, in demanding a Green New Deal. And since then, AOC has just been such a tremendous champion for the Green New Deal and has consistently not just championed the Green New Deal, but championed Sunrise Movement, championed our movement allies, and has really demonstrated in every way what it means to be a movement politician, someone who does not lose their connection to the grassroots and to the movement when they get elected, but continues working in alliance as part of a coordinated strategy to get this done together. And AOC isn't the only one either. Of course, we have Ilhan Omar, we have other members of the squad, and they've been tremendous examples of what it means to be a champion. So I can't say enough good things about AOC and Ilhan and the rest of them. And we're going to have a lot of opportunities in years to come because of the work that they're doing.
Talk to us about the role of Sunrise in the election. Talk to us about your mobilization of young people. What are you up to in this crucial moment? Because you've already said it in answer to Jeff that, you know, you think it's incredibly important that Joe Biden gets elected.
We had to reorient our plans due to the coronavirus. But even in spite of that, we've been able to contact millions of young voters throughout the primary and general election cycle. I think one good example of that is Jamal Bowman, who is a newly elected representative from New York State, who's going to join the squad proudly alongside Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, made 1.3 million phone calls in his campaign. And Sunrise Movement made 850,000 of those phone calls. And I've just got to give so much love to our phone banking team. They're called the Force to be Reckoned With team, and they really are. It's run largely by high schoolers and other teenagers. And they have an incredible culture that they've built. They've really built community, online community, in the midst of the coronavirus, with people who come back day after day after day, phone banking and supporting each other and doing that in the midst of this coronavirus where we're all locked up inside. And that's really been the engine of our work. We also have a swing state program in key states here for the general election, where we're doing special work there as well, including planning to defend the results should Trump try to steal the election after he loses. So it's been an interesting year, and our voter contact team has just been incredibly creative and resourceful because obviously the virus has upended everything. But we're putting everything we got in the direction of defeating Trump.
And obviously, all of the focus at the moment is on defeating Trump. It's not just obviously important for the US. It's absolutely crucial for the world. Talk to us. If, and I know it's an if and nothing can be taken for granted, if Joe Biden wins, how do you see the question from January of next year when he'll be sworn in? How do you see this issue of the Green New Deal kind of unfolding, given that you've got a degree of, you've said he wasn't your candidate, although you're obviously fully supportive of him beating Trump? How do you see that that process unfolding so that you can get the kind of maximal set of demands that you have?
Right away, in the first 100 days or first 45 days, he's going to want to do a big stimulus plan because the economy is in tatters. The Trump and GOP response this year has been utterly inadequate. And so one of the first priorities that the Biden campaign has said, and common sense dictates, that they're going to want to do a big investment package right away in order to get the economy going. And we've been saying that climate change is a jobs program. It's a job creating issue. Joe Biden understands that. He really gets it, actually. We're fortunate for that. And so we are strongly hoping, and we are going to push like hell to make sure that his initial investment stimulus plan that he enacts within the first 100 days includes massive spending on renewable energy, massive spending on water infrastructure, all those other priorities I talked about earlier. That is the first opportunity to get going.
The name of this podcast, Will, is Reasons to be Cheerful. I think you've given us bucket loads of them so far, but you've obviously been at this now for a number of years. Do you feel a sense of possibility as well as an awareness of the massive risks and dangers we face?
I do feel a sense of possibility and hopefulness. I do. And what makes me hopeful is I think we have a resurgence of visionary, progressive, activist energy and organization, not just in the United States, but in other countries around the world. And we are learning and relearning from our ancestors the craft of what it means to build power and the art of what it means to govern a society and organize ourselves well. And I am hopeful that there are some deeply empathetic and compassionate people who are gaining more and more power to organize our societies in more and more humane and caring ways.
Well, look, Will Lawrence, I think after this conversation, every country needs a Sunrise Movement. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate it.
So what did you think of those two really interesting conversations?
I found them both incredibly inspiring. Obviously, Ilhan is this major figure, but in both conversations, the sense that I got is when you think about the upcoming presidential election, it can feel like Joe Biden is a bit of an uninspiring candidate, that he's sort of middle of the road enough not to upset the horses and to beat Trump. But it's difficult to get excited by Joe Biden. But what I took away from both conversations is that the Democratic Party and what will hopefully prove to be his agenda is being shaped by the likes of the Squad and Sunrise. And that's really exciting, that those ideas, the things we talk about on this podcast, could help shape American politics over the next presidential term.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I found the conversation with Ilhan, well, both of them, but the conversation with Ilhan, starting with that, incredibly interesting. I mean, I suppose I feel for her, you know, that Trump's awful attacks on people are awful for anybody. But I think the whole you're not really American stuff is so, you know, for somebody who's a refugee, it must be just incredibly difficult for her. And then I think you're right about, I think this movement, I think the outsize effect of AOC, Ilhan and others is really interesting in moving the center of gravity, obviously Bernie Sanders and his primary campaign and all that. But then just the sort of the movement itself and what, and the effects the movement has had. I mean, I think that's what's also interesting about Will, is that, you know, you think of the Sunrise movement as about young people who are like protesting, but it's very methodical.
Yeah, it's so strategic.
It's very strategic,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not like a sort of, you know, flash mob. You know what I mean?
It's
a really you know, they've obviously really thought hard about, how do we get influence? How do we organize? I think that's such an interesting sort of lesson, that there's real strategy to it. And it does seem like it's shifting the terms of debate. And let's just, you know, we just have to hope like hell that Biden wins.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet @cheerfulpodcast.
Well, as ever, we would love to hear from you. Did you feel similarly inspired by hearing about what's going on over in the States when, you know, we look over there and so much of what we see is bleak? Let us know what you thought. Also, if you've got ideas for future episodes, thoughts on previous episodes, ideas for guests and so on, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us through the website cheerfulpodcast.com. Now, Ed.
Jeff.
We have an email here from Jonathan Rushforth, who says, meritocracy and Ed's shortcut to the top. Says,
You didn't tell me about this one.
Firstly, he says, I really, really enjoy the podcast. It's relaxing.
Excellent.
It's relaxing. That's good to hear. And informative.
Excellent. Well, should we just leave it there then?
Okay, here we go. He says, when I was at the Treasury,
yes,
as a senior policy advisor,
yes,
another man my age had leapfrogged me and was on the Council of Economic Advisers, effectively influencing people many levels above me, having presumably been a researcher for Labour and Gordon Brown. When discussing the problems with meritocracy last week, you might also flag that most appointments of special advisers aren't even meritocratic, let alone fair. One idea for future podcasts could be to how to fix democracy, as many elements of present models look far from democratic.
I'm left speechless.
Well, he also adds,
you go on, as if that's not bad enough, yeah?
Google Jeff from Dynasty if you want to see Ed's haircut from 2002, which I did.
Yeah.
And I will say it's quite similar to your present day haircut.
Let's just have a look. I'm just going to have a look. Let me just have a look now. Jeff Dynasty 2002. Yeah. It's kind of John Kerry-ish, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think my haircut has changed very much. I think that's a fair point. As for the rest of it, I think we'll move on.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we're in the outro.
Yep, we're in the outro. I'm off. Hopefully we're doing some swimming and more swimming at the weekend.
You're like an otter.
Oh, is that a compliment?
It's not an insult.
In fact, actually, I was at the swimming pool the other day near where I live in London, and
in the municipal baths.
Yeah, and then I sort of got out of the swimming pool, and a lady was very exercised about climate change, which I am too. And as I was sort of walking around in my kind of swimming costume in the one-way system, she sort of said, "Could she nobble me?" And I don't know. I don't think I was at my best having a conversation while dripping wet.
You don't want to be nobbled while you're dripping wet in your Speedos. You've got your Veruca sock on. There's a time and a place.
I did think it's a sort of funny life being a politician, isn't it? You sort of, you know, you get nobbled at the most unlikely moments. And also, I don't quite know why I didn't say, when she said, "Can I nobble you?" I should have just said, "No." But I'm so sort of polite. I was like, "Oh, yes." I don't think I was quite at my most sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but sort of cogent.
Nobbleable.
Nobbleable, exactly.
I'm not sure that the word nobble has been used as much this century as it has in the last 2 minutes of this podcast.
Is nobble a retro word?
I think so. Did she use the word nobble, or are you edifying it?
No, I think she said nobble.
Okay. Speaking your language.
What's the modern version of nobble?
Badger.
No. Do I look like a badger? Right, should we do our thank yous?
Yeah.
I would like to thank very much Ilhan Omar and Will Lawrence.
Emma Corsham produces our podcast. Joel Pierce provides all the research with backup from Zoe Gelber, who's been with us this week.
In person backup, yeah. I'll have you know.
Yeah, she's been the invigilator. Sitting there,
the invigilator,
observing, and Fanula DC and Joe Kenyon, of course, work with Joel. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed composed the music. James Deacon made the idents, and the artwork was designed by
Henry Cull. He's been Star Helper.
He's been the Milk Monitor,
and these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.